When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. This week, we're getting right clown to it as we return to the world of Stephen King's It for Chapter 2, as well as hearing from the film's director, Andy Muschietti, and we're reeled in for Mark Jenkins' handmade British debut, Bait. I'm Sam Howlett, and to help me defeat evil, I've reunited with some of the biggest losers I know. Kelly Powell.
Rude.
And Stephen Ryder.
Thank you.
So we are going to be talking about It Chapter 2, as well as speaking to the writer and director, Andy Muschietti. But before that, we're going to talk about Bait. So this is Mark Jenkins' debut, It. We have two brothers, Martin Ward and Stephen Ward. Martin is a cove fisherman without a boat, and his brother Stephen has repurposed their father's vessel as a tourist tripper, driving a wedge between the brothers. With a childhood home now a getaway for London money, Martin is displaced to the estate above the picturesque harbour. As his struggle to restore the family to their traditional place creates increasing friction with tourists and locals alike, a tragedy at the heart of the family changes his world. And I think for a lot of people that probably sounds like a very generic British sink, you know, drama.
Yeah, I was going to say.
British sink or kitchen sink?
British sink.
British sink.
It's a new genre, Kelly.
British kitchen sink drama. But the way this film's made is what really, I think, makes it something special.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because the synopsis for a film like this doesn't really do it justice in what it's trying to do. The thing that I was most impressed about with Bait is that you are getting a lot of kind of BFI-backed projects at the moment that are coming out and having a lot of money put behind them. And they're looking very slick. They're looking, you know, things like Lady Macbeth that came out a couple of years ago was like a slick looking film, and it had a beautiful kind of
stately
like mise-en-scene to it and stuff, and very easy to watch, very easy on the eye. This is it's still a beautiful film, but it's done in such a specific way, on like grainy, I think it's 16mm that they shot it on. No sound recorded during the kind of production. Everything was added post, which gives it an incredible kind of unique quality.
Quite dreamy.
People have been saying dreamlike. I would go for that as well. And I think they definitely lean into the dreamlike aspect of it a lot by focusing on like weird textural moments in the film instead of the actual plot itself. But I think I have yet to see this on the big screen, but I feel like it would be quite an experience to see that kind of window into another world, even though it is just kind of contemporary Cornwall.
Yeah, it is just, it's like, I think, you know, the juxtaposition of it being on this really old film stock that we're not used to seeing, but we're seeing modern day people and their lives. And then it's like those juxtapositions throughout the film, you know, the newcomers, the new money, the old school, small fisherman town, the way that the sound is done as well. It's displacing in a way. It's like, it's just off center.
If anyone that's seen like a Guy Maddin film, I think, would definitely draw parallels. I think it's the easiest parallel to make, in the sense that you, like you just said, you're watching these very contemporary and also like kind of violent in a way. Like there's not a lot of violence in the film, but there's a very, like, there's an aggression in the film.
There's a harshness to the way it looks and the way everyone speaks to each other.
Yeah.
And well, it's interesting what you said. There's something really jarring about seeing a MacBook on black and white 16mm, this sort of rickety looking thing that really, it really jars you and it really knocks you back a bit and makes you question what you're watching. And
it's weirdly anachronistic.
I really like that about it. You don't get to see that kind of enough, because it kind of does just eschew all manner of the last kind of all of the technological innovations that have happened in the last 100 years of filmmaking, and says, actually, we're going to make a contemporary film about a very contemporary subject of gentrification outside of London, which is great to see, because we're seeing another story. And we're going to do it in a very kind of obtuse, archaic style. And that alone is enough for me to be intrigued by a film. But it's a good job that, you know, they're actually telling a really interesting and at times really funny story about this kind of subject.
Yeah, the humour's definitely there. There's the scene in the pub about, you know, halfway through or something, and there's a particular line about someone having a plum in their mouth that really, really, really made me laugh. And I didn't think this film would do that.
No. It's definitely got... I'm not sure if the director himself is from Cornwall.
He is,
because his previous short film was about a similar subject, or at least about kind of the political kind of things going on in Cornwall. But he knows this film that he's making. He knows the best places to shoot in. He knows these characters, he's met these people before, and you really get a sense for that. It's certainly
very personal.
Yeah, it's very personal. I went to see The Souvenir last night, and it was a film, obviously that's a film about a director making a film about something they know, and very like targeted, this is what I know, this is what I'm making a film about. And at times that made me a little bit like roll my eyes a little bit, but this, you sense that he's wants to make this movie. He wants to tell this story.
Yeah, it's like a need
to do it. And I think it's so great for the BFI to give a voice to this kind of director.
Absolutely.
That's coming from this kind of background, you know.
And just doing experimental things with film. Like, come on, let's back these people who still want to mess with the form of it, you know?
Yeah, and it's the kind of camera where you have to wind it, I think, and you can only film 2 minutes at a time.
Amazing.
I love that.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful. And it has those moments. The one thing I did want to point out, just beautiful, like, aesthetic moments, are when a scene will change and the scene will go from, like, bright white and kind of fade in to the scene, and the images will come, like, in onto the screen. They'll fade in and dissolve in.
Yeah.
And I just think that was so nice to see, because I haven't seen anything like that ever before, I think, in this kind of film. So one reason to see it in a cinema on the big screen is moments like that that really just capture the essence of what the filmmaker's trying to do.
Absolutely. So he shot it, directed it, wrote it, edited it, did the sound, did the score. Really impressive feature debut from Mark Jenkins. And that you can catch that in cinemas now. It's also part of our Curzon Voyagers season. This is our selected programming strand. You can find out more on curzon.com/voyager. So we do like sort of more obscure films that aren't getting a super wide release, and we do bigger discounts for members for those films as well. So do check out that. Okay, so we are going from small town Cornwall to small town Maine, where the horrors of capitalism and gentrification are replaced by the horrors of a killer clown. Stephen, tell us about It Chapter 2.
So, yeah, It Chapter 1, huge hit.
Biggest horror film of all time in box office.
Yeah, which is just crazy to think about.
700 million.
People forget how incredibly popular the book was, though. But yeah, basically, it takes the book was just one big volume, and this takes kind of the second story within that volume about the Losers Club, who in the first film we saw them vanquish kind of the evil entity that takes the form of Pennywise the Clown and many other forms in the first film, and preys on fear. They vanquish it at the end of the first film, and this film begins 27 years later. Pennywise has returned, as the kind of the mythos goes, and the Mike Hanlon, the librarian in the town, one of the original members of the Losers Club, he's the only one to have stayed behind. But he realizes that Pennywise has returned, and he sets out to reunite the Losers Club, bring them back so they can fight Pennywise off one last time, and try and kind of save their small town and save their own kind of psyches from all this trauma that's been happening. If you've seen the first film, if you've seen It Chapter 1, then I think you kind of know what to expect going into It Chapter 2, just with a kind of entirely new cast.
Right. So this film sees Andy Muschietti returning, So He Did It, Chapter 1. He's back here to carry on what he started. Stephen, you spoke to him?
I did. He's a really lovely guy. Did get a sense that there's a bit of Pennywise in him. I'm not gonna lie. He's a very tall man. They held the interviews in the experience in the
It was
London
weird when
vaults.
He bit your arm off, wasn't
very
it?
Very strange, yeah. they held the interviews in the London vaults, where they're doing this kind of interactive It scare experience. They've got all these amazing kind of sets lined up and people jumping out at you. It was a great place to do it, because I think it really kind of captured the essence of the film in a way. We talked a lot about the humour in the film and his kind of making an American film, even though he's an Argentine filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Here's Andy Muschietti.
Hi, Andy. Pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you.
So, kind of a strange junket in a very strange place. Have you had a chance to do the experience?
Oh,
yet?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah? What was it like?
Phenomenal.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's great, because it's like, it really got me, you know?
Yeah? Was it like being in your film? Or
no, it's scarier, actually.
Scarier?
Well, you know, when you make a film, you can't really scare yourself. Uh-huh. When the scare is coming and you know how the suspense is going. This is different, because I didn't plan this. Someone else did.
So I think everybody, especially audience-wise, kind of going into this, if they're buying a ticket for It Chapter 2, they know it's going to kind of be a terrifying experience. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to do is kind of look at some of the other elements of the film, which I think were so brilliantly handled. And a big part of that for me was, and one that surprised me, was the humor in the film, the comedy element of it. And I just wanted to ask you why you kind of infused the film with so much humor and why you think horror and comedy or horror and humor work so well together?
Well, there's like several reasons, you know. There's like probably the most like instinctive one is I grew up watching movies in the 80s, and one of my favorite movies, horror movies, have a lot of humor in it. You know, Evil Dead, American Werewolf in London, Fright Night, to mention a few of them. I'm kind of imprinted with that kind of storytelling. Like humor and horror go hand in hand for me. It's always like a more exciting experience. Humor also, you know, help the audience connect emotionally with the characters, like faster. So it's some sort of like, you know, shortcut to the audience's heart. People feel better when there's a little humor in it. They feel more engaged. And then the combination of humor and horror also provides that, you know, that sense of unpredictability, where, you know, as an audience, you never know if the scene will end up in a joke or in a chopped head, you know.
I kind of feel like that's a very Pennywise thing to say, because in a way, he's directing a lot of these set pieces that these characters are experiencing, and he's kind of disarming the audience in the same way that you are before kind of scaring them at the end.
Oh yeah, well imagine a movie that takes the story seriously, you know, when you have a monster that is like a jokester, you know. I don't see how that would be possible.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And also, like, life is you know, is made of all of these elements. Life is drama and pain, but it's also, you know, humor and, you know, comic relief to cope with shitty elements. So, and Stephen King knows this very well. And so he includes everything in it, and that's how I, you know, sort of learned to tell stories, by reading his books. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, even the adaptations made from his films, like Creepshow, is one that I always go back to and forget how funny it is, but at the same time, like, completely disturbing. Anyways. So I've heard you talk a little bit as well about how you preferred kind of working on It Chapter 2, because you had a chance to combine the stories of the children and the adults in the same way that the book does, which is one of the reasons why I prefer the second chapter as well, the kind of dueling narratives. Could you talk a little bit about why you think that works so well in this film?
Well, there was a clear intention on the first one to tell only the story of the kids, because I thought it was like, you know, the purest way of telling the story without interferences. So it was the closest to, you know, to the best way to get the audience immersed in their story and connected emotionally with them. But I love so much the dialogue between the timelines in the book, that in the second one, for me, was like, no question that I would go back to them. It works very well because I think that people that love the movie really connected with those characters as children. Really felt for their, you know, their journeys when they were kids. And now they meet these characters like 27 years later, and they need, basically, they see what they are now because these characters are reintroduced in the story, but they need to make the connection of how of what happened, why, you know, why is it that these characters wound up being what they are, you know, and it's all because like the story itself implies that there was something that happened back in that summer that that cemented their way for the rest of their lives.
I really enjoyed the fact that you kind of play with the idea of when you're young, your fears are very specific and very targeted, and as you get older, they become a little bit you know, you turn into an adult, they become more complex and a little bit more deeply rooted. Was that something you had in mind going into the second, definitely.
The first movie has like a little bit more of a naive look because it's like you know, it's sort of narrated from the point of view of children, and they're, you know, their scares are about the woman in the painting who's scary that comes back to life, or the leper, you know, that is like full of infection. The second movie, even though it has the same tone, lives in the same world as the first one, has like deeper themes, and it's really, you know, it's about fears that we feel as adults, and they're definitely more layered and profound. So the look at these fears is you know, more like through the eyes of a more mature lens.
Yeah, no, for sure. I did feel that this was a mature film, as well as the way it looked. The production design was just incredible in this film. But as an Argentine, do you find it difficult to kind of recreate Americana in this way? Or is this something that you learn from like the people around you or from watching films, TV?
Not really. I grew up in Argentina, but I grew up watching all kinds of movies and a big amount of American movies. So the Americana aesthetics are very much imprinted, you know, and so when it came to recreate Derry, you know, of course I did some research and I went to Bangor, the real Derry, Bangor in Maine. And of course you're working with people that, you know, our production designer Paul Osterberry, who is incredibly talented production designer, came in with all his knowledge and research, so it wasn't that difficult, you know.
That's really good to hear because it's worked out really well.
Thank you very much.
One of the last things I kind of wanted to ask you was, I absolutely loved from the very beginning of the film, we get a lot of references to endings and conclusions, especially through kind of Bill. And kind of ending a story is something that Stephen King's been criticized for his whole career. And you obviously highlighted this. Could I ask why you did that and where endings kind of fit into the mythos of like It?
Well, it's you know, it's a great thing to, like, in the case of Bill Dembro, who is a bit of an alter ego of Stephen King. You know, Bill's journey is about guilt and not finding a conclusion to his traumatic journey, which is basically not being able to resolve the fact that he killed his own brother. So it's a guilt like journey, and that's why he's struggling with endings, because he doesn't want to, like, ending that scene, that journey for him would be recognizing what he did, and he's been like sort of like, you know, suppressing it. I have a personal experience with bad endings, which is my movie Mama, which a lot of people didn't like the ending. And it's not, I don't think it's a bad ending at all, but many people, like, you know, accuse me of like shit, like having like a, you know, disappointing ending. What can you do about it?
Well, an ending for a horror film is a very difficult thing to do, because you either end it and everyone goes home happy and nobody's scared, or you kind of end it in a bad way and people are disappointed because it's not got a...
Or you're telling a story about a monster and the ending is about humanizing that monster and people are like, no. Why would you do that?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, if you do want to find out what happens at the end of It, definitely go and see it. So thank you for joining us, Andy. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy Muschietti. So I think the big thing going into It Chapter 2 is how does it compare to It Chapter 1, which, as we've said, is the biggest horror film of all time, was this huge phenomenon, much bigger than anyone expected it to be. How does it compare to that for you guys?
I really liked it. I think it definitely picks up exactly sort of, it throws you right back into mm-hmm. where you left off with Chapter 1. I think that the casting was excellent. Mm-hmm. And I think that that adds to it. You know, you're like excited to see what the kids look like growing up and like where they are in their lives and how they come back together. And that's sort of done within this first act of the film. And then they're back in the town and then it starts from there and it doesn't stop really till the end.
Yeah, it's my biggest gripe with the first film is that, because I did read the book when I was younger, I haven't read it for a long time, but I really enjoyed chapter to chapter the timelines changing.
Because alternates,
yeah,
right?
Alternates. Yeah. And my biggest gripe with the first film is that by focusing entirely on the kids, you lose a lot of what the book was trying to do in kind of mirroring a child's fear against an adult's fear and how, you know, you cope with fear through kind of different ages. Mm. But I was so happy to see that this film doesn't just leave the kids behind. Mm. It does, I think, what Andy Muschietti always wanted to do. Mm. And it blends the storylines together. And for me, that means that this film is... It's very, very similar to the first one in a lot of ways, but I think that aspect of it kind of tips it over for me as being a better film.
Mm. And it's interesting, I think that he's dealing with a lot of... not in a very overt way, but he's dealing with a lot of heavy subject matter in terms, you know, trauma, memory, fears, societal fears,
like repression.
Yeah. Those things are big things, but he does it with such a light touch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all underneath, and you can read into that if you want to, but it's also just highly, highly entertaining.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's. I think you're probably a big fan of the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Oh, yeah.
But I've never seen a film kind of capture that playfulness of Nightmare on Elm Street and Freddy Krueger, and that kind of, I would hesitate to call, as they went on, the Nightmare on Elm Street films became more comedic.
Definitely.
But they always had that sense of playfulness in them, and I've never seen a film kind of capture that so well since that series of maybe like things like The Evil Dead as well.
Mm.
But this is just so good at kind of having you terrified 1 minute and laughing the next, and I think that's really great to see in a mainstream horror film.
Definitely.
Yeah, well, you know, as he said, you can, it does make you empathize with them more because you share a joke and you're in on it almost, and mm-hmm. then you're kind of, you're with them for the rest of the film.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what do we think of this new cast then? So we've got James McAvoy, Jessica Chastain, Bill Hader. How did these new additions work for you?
I thought Hader was fantastic.
Bill Hader is amazing.
He's going to be getting so...
Do you think supporting actor? Maybe.
Oh, I'd love to see it. I'd like to see it.
It's the kind of performance that sometimes sneaks in.
Mm. 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 I mean, it depends, I guess, how the Oscars feel about a horror film.
Yeah.
Because this is a great performance, and it's so hard to get on the wavelength of this film and then give a great performance. Like, because it is such a mishmash of genres, and you're never really sure whether to be scared or whether to be laughing. And I think Bill Hader just, like, is... fully on that wavelength, and he knows when to be kind of an empathetic character, and he knows when to be a funny character.
Yeah.
He even knows when to be really annoying.
Yeah.
Like, he's really annoying in this film and kind of an ass, like, a lot. Yeah. But he does the character of Richie Tozier so much justice, and I think he's a big character in the books. Mm. He's a really important part of the story, and I think he does so well to bring that character to life.
And Richie Tozier could be the worst character. He could be so annoying on screen, couldn't
mm-hmm.
he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, in the books, I think they call him a trash mouth in the film.
Richie Trashmouth.
Yeah, but in the books, he's really annoying, but also super, super empathetic. And I think you can clearly tell that Bill Hader's read the book and he cares about this character.
Mm.
Yeah, he's so, so good in it.
Everyone's doing really good work, though. I mean, Jessica Chastain clearly cares about this kind of subject as well.
Yeah, of course. Cool. Yeah. They do something really interesting with Richie's character in the film. And he's really actually a complex individual. Obviously, they all are, and they've all got trauma, and they're all dealing with their trauma in different ways. But it's there's an interesting way that he plays with societal fears, Andy. You know, current day fears, and how that manifests.
Yeah, it's there right from the start. And I mean, there's just to make sure the audience are aware, there are a lot of jump scares in this film as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And so sometimes it can be quite difficult to kind of remember that you are there's actually a story here, and like
not just a ghost train.
No, yeah. It's not just
not a theme park ride.
It is also that. Like, yeah. But there are a lot of jump scares in it. I mean, the biggest one for me was probably near the beginning of the film when Peter Bogdanovich like comes down on the crane. Really scared the crap out of me. Yeah.
That's probably the loudest I screamed because I saw that Peter Bogdanovich is in this film.
But there's some really great cameos in it though. You get for the art house crowd, if you're a Xavier Dolan completist, you got to see it. You got to come see this movie.
There's the third cameo that I don't think we should spoil.
Yes, because it comes a little bit later
and
on.
And it's a good one.
Yeah.
It's really well done.
The two that I have spoiled are right at the start, but there's a really great cameo.
I mean, we can't not tell people that Peter Bogdanovich is in this.
I just love Peter Bogdanovich, though. He's always been like in and out of my life with The Sopranos and like various things. And now he comes out of nowhere on this crane and plays this really like acidic.
He's playing. They call him Peter. He is playing himself.
Oh, I love
it. I really want to see the film, the horror film that Peter Bogdanovich is directing.
100%. Yeah, Andy Muschietti could easily pull something like that off. easy.
So speaking of scares, then Pennywise is back. Mm-hmm. Bill Skarsgård is back, and I was thinking on the way here: has there been a horror character since Ghostface and Scream, where like it's that iconic, that recognizable horror villain that people dress up as on Halloween, that is so instantly, that's the guy from that film? Because I can't think of one since Scream, really.
No, I think they've
horror have moved away from that kind of thing. And I think Pennywise is the new horror monster at the moment.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, it's funny as well because he takes up so many forms.
Yeah.
Like to scare these, to kind of mirror the fears of the various members of the Losers Club. But Pennywise, they really kind of do an interesting thing here where they're honest in the way that they've adapted the books, and they really go deep into the mythology of what this thing is.
Yes, they do. Mm.
Yeah.
I was surprised at that. I thought that's the stuff you could maybe chop out to be kinder to
the
audience that just wants to have fun.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they give you the mythology of this thing.
They trust Andy Muschietti with telling the story. And he said, look, I want to put in a lot about who he is and who it is and where it came from. And they don't shy away from that. It's probably like a big chunk of the film that we're looking at. But we also get that strange scene with him, like with his makeup, clawing away at it. And that made me want to know more. And I think that's really cool that they've done that, in that they have exposed a lot of what this thing is, but they're also kind of like still dropping little hints in there as to like this bigger mythology, which is very Stephen King-esque, because obviously his books all kind of link together.
Oh, yeah.
And there's even been rumors of an It Chapter 3. Which I, I'm on the fence about. But
do you know who was originally going to play Pennywise?
Mm-mm.
Will Poulter.
Will Poulter would have been great.
Wow.
Got a creepy face.
Yeah, I mean, I love Skarsgård in this, but like Will Poulter's a really interesting actor.
Be very different, Pennywise, I think.
He's a really tall man.
Bill Skarsgård. Well. Yeah.
No, both of them.
Oh,
Will
really?
Poulter too.
Yeah.
Really tall.
Yeah, he is tall.
So it would have worked, I think. You know.
But I think Bill Skarsgård's performance, I thought he was incredible in the first one. And he's just scene after scene, he brings it home, and it's hard to tell what's special effects and what's him, because apparently the eyes is all him. Like, he can do that with his eyes.
The eyes are amazing. Yeah.
And the voice, that evil Scooby-Doo kind of thing.
Are you Georgie?
Look, I really like the drum scares, because that's obviously what half the fun of going to a horror film is about. But I think that he shines in the moments where the scare is quieter and creepier. There's one scene where you get to see the Pennywise that we were scared of in the first one, and that's
beneath
great.
Beneath the bleachers. That's an incredible
moment.
That's
such a good scene. Yeah,
brilliantly like constructed. Really, really well.
And that really mirrors the opening of the first film, because I remember seeing the first film, and the first one opens with a demonic clown biting the arm off a very small child, and that's such a clear message of intent films are.
This is Spielberg Jaws trick, isn't it?
Yeah, this is like, you are not, no one is safe in this film if you kill a kid, and the way they kill that kid in the first film was really, really horrible. But I was proper like, oh my god, I can't believe this is happening in this mainstream, looks like it could be a PG-13 horror film. Obviously it isn't, but you know what I mean, it's such a shocking moment for this kind of film, and this film carries that kind of mentality on, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't hold anything back.
No, I completely agree. And I think that that is one of the reasons why, like you were saying, he's become such an iconic monster, is because he is kind of a ruthless, like, genuinely evil kind of...
Because he doesn't have feeling.
No,
like, he's got no... He's not human.
Well, the end of this film kind of puts that into question, which I think is really interesting.
That's, yeah, true.
To spoil anything, but, like, that's kind of where this film is headed, is that, like, we do question, like, what evil is and why it does the things it does and, you know, how do we suppress it?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really, really fascinating. I work with, like, I work in a lot of... with a lot of younger audiences now in the job that I do, and they love Pennywise. They think he's so funny and, like, so scary at the same time. So they've really latched onto something here, and it doesn't surprise me that there's talk of it chapter three.
He's the new Freddy.
Yeah, he is. He is the new Freddy.
He's got Freddy lines. Krueger. He's got the cool makeup. You can easily dress up as him on Halloween.
It surprises me though, because the Tim Curry original it was for me. I mean, I think Pennywise is great, but I'm not so sold on the look of the clown.
Oh really?
Yeah, I think that clowns are scary anyway, and when you give them like giant teeth and like
claws and
eyes, like, it's still scary.
Yeah.
But it's not scary in the same way. Like, if a clown was stood outside this recording studio just looking in now, that would be scary regardless of
what they look like.
The claws and the other stuff.
Yeah.
Part of like that fear comes from like it just being there.
Yeah.
And it
shouldn't
be there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that being said, like, I think that Skarsgård does still manage to pull out a performance, which is hard under all that makeup.
It is.
So,
it is.
Yeah. Massive props to him.
What were the kind of Pennywise iterations that stood out for you in this film? Because I know my absolute favourite. Spiderhead.
Spiderhead.
I
loved Spiderhead.
I mean, it's a it's the thing, obviously, but it's...
They even say the line, don't they?
Yeah. It really surprised me that there was a spider head in this film, and whose head it is really interesting for that whole group as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what the spider head does, I just loved spider head.
I thought that was very cool. Like, this is such an inventive film.
It's really inventive.
In that way, yeah.
And the fortune cookie monsters.
Fortune cookies are great.
They were horrible.
Great,
like the baby wasp thing.
The thing like dragging itself.
Yeah.
Along,
God.
That's really horrible.
Just really horrible.
Really horrible stuff.
Me and Kelly were talking post-film about the jump scare that got me the most. I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but there's a giant statue.
Oh, God, that got me.
Paul Bunyan.
That really got me, yeah.
That is just terrifying. Like, I don't know how you make... It's that thing about how can we take something normal and make it scary, and that's kind of a lot of what the theme is about. How can we take this inanimate object or this kind of nothingness and suddenly make it into the most terrifying thing you've ever come across in your life.
As someone that watches a lot of horror films, I'm such a sucker for a jump scare.
Yeah, me too.
Like, they really get me really bad.
It's because you can see them coming.
Yeah.
You know, they're really playing with you in this film.
Mm.
Kelly, you liked The Odd Lady, didn't you?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I like that scene a lot. Because, again, because it's a little bit more of a drawn-out, creepy scene that you get the scare at the end, but it's like... It makes you sit in it for quite a long time.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
I think that's one of the standout scenes. Mm. And also, if anyone's seen Andy Muschietti's short film, Mama, which he eventually expanded into his first feature, the way he shoots the ghost monster in that short film, the way it sort of twitches and turns, is very similar to what the old lady does in this scene in the background.
Yeah.
And it's a really inventive scare.
I love background stuff like
that. Yeah.
I love when you can see when you're aware of something happening in the background of a scene and the main character isn't.
Yeah.
That puts like
the tension.
Yeah, it heightens the tension so much. And when Muschietti gets it right in this film, like it really sings. Like it really, really sings.
The enormous book is here. They've pushed the second half of that book down into 3 hours and they've changed the time setting, haven't they? So the book has the kids in the 50s and the adults in the 80s, obviously when the book was written. We've now got the kids in the 80s and the adults in the 2000s. What does that time change do for the film, do you think, and for the story?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think the 80s is very in right now.
It's obviously very in,
you know.
The first film came out around the time of Stranger Things season 2, when that was enormous. I think it played a big part
exactly.
in it.
Exactly. It's just the new thing. Like, Glow is very much in that sort of realm as well. Mm. So I think, firstly, it's popular. And secondly, it's interesting what it says about the time period of, American politics.
Yeah. When Stephen King wrote the book, he wanted to write about kind of that post-war feeling of bliss, of American bliss, and everything was okay, and nobody was worried. But the reality of the situation was there was all this awful stuff happening underneath the surface that we weren't aware of. And eventually, you know, the 80s come along, which is where the second part of the book is set, and all those fears and all those insecurities have come to the surface. And I think, I think you're right, Kelly. I think this film is doing the same thing, but with contemporary times.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is the first scene is a big example of that. Obviously.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think, it's what the 50s and 60s were to the people in the 80s, you know, this American dream. That's sort of playing on what Trump is hearkening back to, you know, make America great again. You know, let's go back to Reaganite America.
This is it. This is exactly
so it's
it.
Interesting what he's doing and what kind of comment he's making on current day America, Trump's America, and the fears underlining that and how the current administration preys on those fears.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The opening scene of this we've mentioned, but I think that's really interesting positioning of the film, where that Derry, the small town, the fictional town from Derry, is one of these American towns that has been taken over by this sort of mentality, and it's now an even more dangerous place.
Yeah,
rather than, you know, it's not just monsters here; there are other things happening as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's a really unsettling way to start this film.
Yeah,
but this is why Stephen King loves setting his films in these places because they. Usually in his books, he centers the action on a very specific place, as if it's a place of evil.
Yeah.
But all he's really doing is making a metaphor for the whole of America or even the whole of the world, in that you can hide behind all this tranquility as much as you want, but there's still always going to be something happening under the surface.
Hmm.
Very David Lynch in a way,
yeah.
But doing it in a very different way. As far as the 80s stuff goes, our producer Jake messaged me. Apparently, the Duffer Brothers had something to do with the original script for this film.
Well, they were in the running to make it Chapter One before they did Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
And their approach was set in the 80s.
So they basically did it anyway.
Yeah. And they didn't get the job because it went to Cary Fukunaga.
Ah, of course. And by that point,
they'd made Stranger Things. Yeah. And then they gave it to Andy Muschietti. Hmm. And I guess the influence of the Stranger Things creators has kind of lingered in this film.
Yeah, definitely.
And
definitely.
I mean, I think that's all for the best. I think that's fine, really. I think the first one has a kind of Amblin-y feel, and I think that approach works for this film.
Mm, no, I agree.
These characters looking back on that time, the way we're looking back on the 80s now with a kind of rose-tinted, like you say, with things like Stranger Things and Glow, we're looking back at the 80s as this like golden period of when everyone was... It was cool, it was fun. And I think that works for the fact that you've got characters now that have grown out of that and have to face facts that it wasn't like that for them at all.
Mm.
All right, so that's it Chapter 2, which you can see in cinemas now, and also Bait. And if you have any thoughts on those two films, you can let us know. You can email podcast@curzon.com or you can tweet us @CurzonCinemas. Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please rate, review and subscribe. We're available on iTunes, Acast or wherever you get your podcasts. podcasts. You can turn your attention to Cousin Home Cinema, where we are showing Joanna Hogg's The Souvenir, and you can catch up with our interview with Joanna on last week's episode. And in events, Kelly.
Yeah, so you guys can catch the Open City Dark Fest that's happening early September, which is now, at Curzon Soho. Some really, really good films out there, so book your tickets to go see some.
It's an incredible festival.
Yeah. And then also we have some more Souvenir screenings, along with Bird's Eye View, Reclaim the Frame. That's happening at Oxford, Wimbledon and Canterbury this weekend. So check it out if you're keen to go along for some additional content. And then also Fleabag, the live dates are sold out, but cinemas still have multiple encores to book for. So get your tickets to go see Fleabag.
Great. And you can all find that at curzon.com/events.
Correct.
Okay. And that is goodbye from Stephen.
Pop, pop.
Goodbye from Kelly.
Bye, Kelly.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me.
Hiya, Georgie.
Pop, pop, Georgie. You like popcorn, Georgie?
I've been doing that a lot.